Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Anthony Anderson, Philip Beverly, Marty Garrity, and David Masiotra. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in downtown Chicago. And our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's brucedumont@museum.tv. And if you'd like to tweet us a question, it's @Dumo. And again, if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web for past broadcasts, you can go to our website, beyondthebeltway.com. We have a full 2 hours for you this evening for those listening coast to coast on radio, and that is that we're going to be talking about what happened in Iraq and U.S. military policy there. That will be in hour number two. We'll be talking about the indictment of Texas Governor Rick Perry with a live report from Kenny Remeyer, who is with KLBJ Radio in Austin, and we'll hear that in hour number two, but we will begin with the situation in Ferguson, Missouri. It is dominated news, the shooting of Michael Brown by a local officer who's been identified as Darren Wilson, and also the actions of the police chief, Thomas Jackson, and all of those involved in covering and being responsible for this death of this young man. We're going to be talking about it this evening from all perspectives. If you are a community activist working in the African-American communities around the United States, we would be very much interested in your perspective tonight. And if you are a law enforcement officer, especially one who is maybe currently involved in dealing with crime in the United States, we especially reach out to you to offer your perspective of this very complicated factor. And it becomes complicated when the news, as it leaks out, and stories and events begin to play out in the court of public opinion as opposed to a court of law. Philip Beverly is one of our guests this evening. He's been described as a Democrat, but I don't think anybody's necessarily a Republican or Democrat tonight. Philip Beverly, what is your perspective of what happened in that town and the response of the people in that town?
I think there are two things, Bruce. The event is horrific, and I was struck by my own response to it, that I'm not even surprised anymore. And then when I see that the Justice Department, the FBI, has statistics that on average twice a week unarmed black males are shot by white police officers in this country, I just sort of shrug and go, yeah, of course that happens, because I'm not shocked by it anymore. I think that knowing that in that community and then to have it happen was the thing that had it reach a boiling point. I'm sure there's other issues in Ferguson. I guarantee you there's other issues in Ferguson, and this was just the match that set it off.
Marty Garrity is one of our Republicans or more conservative members of our panel this evening. Marty, what is your reaction to what happened there based on what you know, what you've read, and what you've seen on television?
Well, basically, you should understand that I come from a police family. I have very close relatives who are policemen, retired policemen and policemen. I know their friends. I know that every day when a police wife says goodbye to her husband, she doesn't know she's going to see him later in that day. My instinct in a case like this is to wait until I find out what actually happened and then see if the policeman was right or wrong. But I don't assume, I think almost everybody on TV is assuming, that in this case the policeman was wrong and the innocent, unarmed black man was gunned down. I mean, the very terminology bespeaks judgment.
David Masiotra joins us. David, a libertarian.
Well, I think it's essential and elemental at this point in American history to refuse to see the killing of Michael Brown as an isolated incident. Rather, it's the culmination of a systemic pattern of race-based police brutality, the racialized creation of two tiers of law enforcement, one for blacks, one for whites, and the institutionalized racism of a criminal justice system more criminal than just.
But
so
isn't
in that,
every – I want to just challenge you one point. Your point. Isn't every crime and shouldn't every crime be judged on the specifics of that case? And so it's – you know, we will get to a point of the bigger, broader societal issues. Mm. But in this particular case, as I said before we went on the air, there isn't anyone that's watching this show tonight or listening to this program on radio that knows what happened in that confrontation. No one. The two people that know about it, one is dead, and the other is a police officer who is in hiding for fear for his life. Everyone else is speculating. So I guess my question to you is, we don't know the specifics in this case.
No, that's
it appears that there was an overreaction. That's what these things all appear that way.
No, that's correct. And as we wait for more facts to come forward, we can make a more careful analysis. However, you asked why people are responding the way they are to it in Ferguson and really nationally. I think it's because the bullet-ridden body of Brown has become a symbol for all of the other unarmed black men killed by police, for stop and frisk disproportionately targeting young black men, for the war on drugs, which disproportionately impacts black men.
I want to get Anthony Anderson's response. Anthony, you're usually on this program. You are unique in that you're an African-American Republican. You've been involved in the criminal justice system, the juvenile criminal justice system, for 22 years as a working for the Department of Corrections. Go ahead.
Yeah, when I look at the latest footage on this young African-American being shot down, I see a number of things. The day that happened, I saw the video of when this individual was inside the store shoving the person, the owner of the store, supposedly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, working within the Department of Correction and Juvenile Justice, that type of, persona, that type of individual, I see on a consistent basis. I mean, if you look at this individual, he wasn't a small little boy. He was 6'4", 240 pounds.
What you're talking about you're talking about the release of the surveillance video.
Absolutely.
That was released by the police. And it was something allegedly that the Justice Department did not want.
Well, they didn't want to see that picture released because they're used to seeing.
And this is when he's well, with the
media gave
store.
Us a portrayal that this was a young knight, like the with Trayvon Martin. You know, the pictures of young, innocent little guy. You know, an honor student just getting out of school, and that's what this picture portrayed. But then when the police set this photo out, this video with this individual inside the store, all of a sudden everybody took a look back and said, "Hey, listen, maybe this guy wasn't as innocent as he's being portrayed."
Philip,
to be.
Can you speak just to this very important video?
So the video for me was irrelevant. And to Anthony's point, he gets tried, convicted, and executed because he pushes somebody
absolutely
in a store?
Absolutely not. But then, it goes then, back to then, his original
then
behavior.
Then discuss to me about the relevance of the
video.
Discuss to me about the relevance of the video.
When you are in trouble, do you call 1-800-HUG-A-THUG or do you call 911? Who do you want to show up when there's an event outside of your house or anywhere in America? Do you want to call the police or do you call a thug?
Is that what this comes down to?
No, it's not what it comes down to. But
then what's your point?
The fact of the matter is this individual may or may not have been the wrong person at the wrong time, but we know for certain that more facts have had to come out in order for us to make a more informed decision.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. That video that was referenced is just one piece of this story. There's a much bigger and deeper issue. We'll talk about that when we come back. I'm Bruce Dumont from Chicago. Come on back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. Before we went to the break, we were in sort of a heated discussion about the video, the convenience store video that shows Michael Brown before he became a famous Michael Brown. And Philip, you were in the middle of making a point during the break, and I want you to make that point.
Which one exactly?
Well, the point, the video that was released, the video was released by the police chief. And the Justice Department allegedly was upset that information was released because it shows the victim in an undignified, unpleasant, a thug-like with thug-like activities. And it was allegedly that store owner that called 911 which caused the police response, which ended up with Michael Brown being dead.
You're putting it lightly, Bruce. He was committing a crime. That's what he was doing.
Well, he was committing...
He was committing a crime.
And what he was
committing
doing,
a crime.
He was committing a crime, but let me just
but
say...
But does the...
Well, I want to just ask you this, because you interrupted me with that, but that's okay. Let me clarify.
Okay.
That crime does not warrant... That's not a death sentence.
Absolutely not. I agree wholeheartedly.
So where we go from what we saw, what the American people have seen, because the piece of this story that we have not seen is we haven't seen what happened at the police car. Now, if you watch television, you will frequently see dashboard video of American police officers behaving badly. There was one just in the last week of a woman, a black woman on the street somewhere, I believe it was in Los Angeles or in California, where she was beaten about the head severely, and it was caught on dashboard video. We see that with some, unfortunately, with some degree of regularity. We see police officers behaving badly because of this ever-present video that is now part of our life. In this particular case, there was a convenience store video, and if you go into any store in America, there is video that's you're being videotaped in most cases, certainly in convenience stores. Mm-hmm. We saw the release of this videotape, which clearly showed that Michael Brown was no angel. He was pushing around. It appears that he had taken something and was not paying for it. The young shop owner, or the small shop owner, very small compared to Michael Brown, was pushed aside, and we saw that in the video. So the next question that I would have is, when these things happen, that doesn't warrant that if the police stop him, that he deserves to be shot and killed. Certainly not repeatedly, as it has been
Absolutely.
Reported. I mean, that's where I think, in fact, even Al Sharpton, who I don't agree with a lot, he thinks that the issue of the shooting and the number of shots is a key part of this investigation. And I agree with
and
that.
And the thing that's really important is from Act One of the video, whether it should have been released or not, to the knowledge that the police officer had of that video is important.
That's right.
And to after the fact somehow connect the
dots,
the personality traits of the individual, and as an attempt to justify his execution, I think is ridiculous. Yeah,
but that's been a little short-sighted.
Folks, everyone wants to respond. It's going to be a heated discussion. Hopefully, we're adding some light, but we got to keep it in order. Marty, and then Anthony.
Let's remember that earlier you said there were only two people who knew what happened. Actually, there were three. There was a third, the Brown's accomplice in the apparent burglary was...
Alleged burglary.
In the alleged... I said okay. Apparent. Will you give me apparent? He was there. He and Brown were on the street together. And so he knows what happened, too. He saw what happened also. And early on, his contention was that Brown was simply raising his hand and saying, don't shoot, don't shoot. The one benefit of the video is to perhaps impugn the value of his testimony, because he was obviously involved in a crime moments earlier.
And he was talking about his friend.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
And he was talking about his friend. So how credible is that? And the media were giving that a lot of credibility until this guy showed up on the video.
There's a young woman who was driving in the area, who happened to witness the event. According to her testimony, Michael Brown had his hands in the air when he was shot by the police officer. So if she is telling the truth, as Captain Ron Johnson in Ferguson said, the alleged robbery and the shooting are two entirely separate issues. What if he successfully robbed Fort Knox?
Now there are two
prior
other,
to the killing.
There are two
he's
other.
Got his hands in the air and he's shot.
I think it's a
murder.
Let me just say, all right, Anthony, I'm going to go to you, but let me warn everybody on the panel tonight, okay? Let's not deal with who allegedly said what to whom, because we really don't know all the facts at the moment. We're dealing with conjecture. You're talking about a friend. You're talking about a woman passing by. We don't know whether these are viable reports. We don't know whether these are credible sources or not. Neither side knows it. Now, your point.
Getting back to Philip's point, I think it's a little bit disingenuous and even naive to think that an individual acting in with such reckless disregard inside a shop owner's store, would do what he did in that store, and then all of a sudden be ready to leave the store and go to Sunday school. Being around corrections and the environment I've been around in, any individual that acts like that with another human being, generally speaking, I'm not saying this is everybody. I'm not trying to paint anybody with a broad brush.
Right.
But the fact of the matter is, that's not the first time he did that act right there. That wasn't the first time. That's the first time he got caught doing that. Now,
in my opinion. But what we have, so then what we really have there is, even though this is a small convenience store shop owner,
absolutely,
in that particular situation, he represents the authority. He represents the guy that says, no, "Don't you owe me money for that?"
Absolutely.
Just as a police officer who says, "Stop, get out of the car, or put your hands up," represents an authority. Do you see the similarity of the authority figure and how not just Michael Brown? Let's expand this. How many people who are stopped by police may react in a more hostile way than others, Philip?
Yeah, in many communities, the police are an occupying force. And it's amazing the times I drive down certain neighborhoods in the Chicago. I live on the south side, and they've got three on the hood, or they got three on the curb. And I know what's going on. Do they need to be stopped and treated that way? I don't know. Am I safer because they're out doing that? I don't know.
Do they live, and when I say they, I mean African-Americans and in neighborhoods. Are African-Americans in this country forced to live in neighborhoods where they have a feeling that there is an occupation by the police, but the reason the police are there is to try to protect the other people that live there who do not want the mob mentality or the thug-like street corner bullies that exist in every neighborhood? Bullies exist in all neighborhoods. They come in all shapes and sizes. Most of them are big and loud, but there's a reason why there is a large number of police in urban areas in America. Would you acknowledge that?
I would say that, and the case that I would use is Skip Gates. Henry Louis Gates, a Princeton Harvard University professor, mm-hmm. does not live in one of those neighborhoods and yet was arrested for going into his own house.
Right.
So you can't tell me that it's not a race-based issue there. There's something about perception of many white police officers with African-American people that they are going to be treated differently, whether they're a Harvard University professor or some knucklehead 18-year-old on the street.
Marty, would you acknowledge that? You mentioned that you come from a police family. Would you acknowledge that many, at least beat police officers, patrolmen, many of them may have, if not some racist tendency, some, not all, not even a majority, some may have that, and they may look at black people a little bit differently based on either a feeling they have about the color of that person's skin or because of the experiences they have had with people of color in the course of their professional police lives.
Bruce, I don't doubt that there are racists, people who hate people of another race just for being of another race in all walks of life, probably also among policemen and among people whom policemen approach. To say that is not to justify arguing that the police department is an occupying force. I think that's a slanderous thing that's really unworthy of polite discussion.
Well,
occupying force is an army that comes in.
Well, and did you see the police in Ferguson? On Thursday and Friday, if that isn't a militarized police force, you can't tell me. And how did that happen?
They were there to keep the peace.
Why did they need to keep the
peace? Had they not been there, then Ferguson would still be burning today.
Absolutely. How do we know that? That's a counterfactual. You can't prove that.
But if they weren't,
you can't prove if they weren't.
Listen,
that is a counterfactual statement.
All you have
you
to do is look
at
L.A. during the Rodney King riots.
And they stopped what happened.
That is a glaring example why we should have that force in place during times like
this.
Do you want to go back to Rodney King style burning a city? Come on now.
Hang on a second. David.
This is becoming a bit too abstract because you can't dispute the data. Philip makes a profound point about the nature of the police towards the black community. It's adversarial. It's hostile. The stop and frisk disproportionately targets young black men. Amnesty International reports that blacks are more likely than whites to face arrest, trial, and imprisonment for nonviolent drug offenses, even though they don't use drugs at any rates higher than white people.
This is not a matter. The fact of the matter is the place where the crimes are being committed predominantly are in those areas in which those individuals are committing crimes against one another.
But this isn't a matter of, I want to ask you, that's what this is. Let's not get it twisted. I can't ask this question right now because I don't want to give everybody 3 minutes to think of an answer. They'll hear the question. You'll hear the question when we come back. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. I'm Bruce Dumont, a full board of lights. We will engage them in the conversation when we roll on from Chicago. From Athens, Georgia to Austin, Texas, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8029. In the next hour of the broadcast, in about a half an hour, we're going to be talking about the indictment of Texas Governor Rick Perry and what that means not only for his future as a political candidate, but as also as a free man. Kenny Rahmeyer from KLBJ Radio will be my guest. That's in about 35 minutes on Beyond the Beltway. We have a great panel around the table this evening. They are all heated and spirited. We're dealing with a very touchy subject. And Philip Beverly, tell us a little bit more about who you are and why you're here.
By invitation, I'm going to be starting my 23rd year at Chicago State University on Monday as an associate professor teaching political science.
Anthony Anderson.
Chairman of the Republican Precinct Project and also an employee with the Department of Juvenile Justice for the past 22 years.
And a Marine Corps veteran.
Marine Corps, hoorah.
David Masiatro.
I'm a columnist with the Indianapolis Star and a regular contributor to the Daily Beast. And in February, my new book, Mellencamp, American Troubadour, will be at fine bookstores everywhere.
Marty Gurney.
I've been a commercial real estate broker for 41 years, helping people find office space for their companies. I am trying to retire, and I'm avoiding as many deals as I can, but I still am doing a few. I'm trying to retire because I've got 6 kids and 11 grandchildren, and I don't like missing as any moments that I can with them.
I would like to ask everyone this question, but I'm going to ask the people around the table. In the last segment, Philip, you used the term occupation, and you said this is how you feel that a lot of African-Americans feel about the neighborhoods in which they live. If you are an African-American listening to this broadcast, I would love to know whether you agree or disagree with that statement, 1-800-723-8289. Because, Marty, you vehemently disagreed with the perception. An African-American guest was describing his belief of what people in his neighborhoods feel, and you challenged that. Because you saw it differently. Even you, Anthony, you saw it as not so much of an occupation. And I raised the possibility that it wasn't just an occupation. It was for those African-Americans who live in those communities who are victimized by thugs. They see it in a different way. How do they see it? Because we have a difference. We have a difference of how our two African-American guests view what I've asked about.
You know,
tonight.
As I listen to certain shows and outlets and news outlets here, most people would rather see a police presence in their community. Now, to the extent to where you've got police pulling over young black males for whatever reason, you know, harass them, that's one thing. But to have a police presence in your neighborhood is certainly welcomed in a community. As a matter of fact, if you listen to certain stations in Chicago, they're asking, why hasn't the governor called out the National Guard at this point? This isn't Anthony Anderson talking. These are people and that community saying enough is enough
already.
Would
you acknowledge that, Philip?
In terms of Ferguson?
That because there has been so much black-on-black crime, and which is the vast majority of crime in that neighborhood, in those neighborhoods, are black-on-black crime, because there's so much of it, they are concerned and they want a police presence and they don't see it as an occupation. Now, unless you were making specifically the point about what happened in Missouri when there was an over-militarization of a very combustible situation.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things happening here. Do we want police presence? Yes. Do we want police presence to operate within certain parameters? Serve and protect, not harass and intimidate.
Are you referring to police or to criminals?
I think serve and protect always refers to the police since they put it on their cars.
Okay.
I didn't know that criminals have harassing are the criminals in the community.
Would you really say, Philip, that the majority of black people, say, in Chicago, wish there were fewer policemen,
I never said that. I think you're misrepresenting the statement.
Well, you misrepresented the circumstances when you said that they are an occupying force. If they truly are an occupying force, people would resent their presence and would like to see their presence
and,
reduced.
And do you think
but
that
just
their
opposite
presence,
is the case.
Do you think their presence isn't resented?
Do you think there are some people probably resented, Phyllis,
because there's no communications between those communities that the police are policing and the individuals. That's probably the reason.
Anthony,
why so much-
would you acknowledge one of the other issues? Would you acknowledge that in this particular in Missouri, the case in Missouri, where you have a police force in excess of 50 people and there are three African Americans, would you acknowledge that if there were more African American police officers, not just there but everywhere, things might be better.
Bruce, to assume that those people down there would wholeheartedly welcome a police force that was more diverse is a misnomer. We have a diverse police force right here in Chicago. They don't respect the law here. They won't respect the law down in Ferguson. It doesn't matter where these individuals are. They have to respect authority. They have to respect the law. The fact of the matter is these individuals don't. That's why we have the situations we do in the black community. Bruce. There are no individuals that are white with robes on in the black community. These are black people killing black folks, period. End of story, cut and dry. And you have white people, this thin blue line we have down there, trying to protect these people, these individuals from one another. So how do you get from having this big police presence like we were saying, as opposed to having some sort of occupying force? That's not the case.
In my conversations with police officers, and I know several of them, and they've said this is over the last 15, 20 years, and I have occasionally done a ride-along. I haven't done a ride-along for many years. I want to state that. But in the experiences I've had riding with black officers and white officers, not only the impression that I got, but I've heard from white police officers that say that black police officers sometimes are even rougher.
Absolutely.
On the crime,
Bruce,
and those perpetrators
and
in the black
judges hand out sentences that are stiffer to black defendants.
David.
Bruce, there's a CIA term called blowback, which applies here. If you subject a people to a process of stigmatization, terrorizing, traumatization, then eventually there's going to be some blowback. This returns to my original point that this Brown horrific, tragic incident is not an isolated one. One of the consequences, part of the fallout of this systemic pattern of police brutality, abuse of power, what I referred to earlier, the discrepancies in the war on drugs and stop and frisk, is that you divide, in many cases viciously and fatally, the police from the people they're supposed to protect and the laws they're supposed to uphold.
But speak to Anthony's point. The bigger, broader issue here, I mean, I don't disagree with those things and those statistics, but the bigger, broader issue here is there are people in all communities, but tonight we're talking about the African-American community, there are people there that they don't care whether the police officer is black, white, or Chinese. They don't care at all. They don't like authority. They don't like a little shopkeeper saying, hey, you owe me, you know, 98 cents for that candy bar. They push them out of the way. They're thugs. And they act like a thug. And, you know, the quickest people that can pick out those thugs are people who live in the African-American community.
Well, you've got gangsters in all walks of life. And there's no question that gang activity does terrible damage to black neighborhoods, and no one is sympathizing with those kinds of people. But you've also got gangster activity from the police.
Should police treat young black thugs when they see them on the street just by appearance? I'm only going by appearance now. Should they treat young black thug-like people dressed? Should they treat them differently as if a college African-American college professor is walking down the street?
I teach college courses. I've got students, black students, who show up to my classes with their pants down and you know, showing their drawers and dreadlocks and all of that.
Yeah.
They're not thugs. They may have cultivated a style that we associate with hip-hop and prison fashion, but that doesn't make them thugs. I think what you're saying is very close to an endorsement of racial profiling, and I would never support that, and I would hope that no one with any political power would support it. But Stuart, unfortunately, that's not how it is.
Stuart in XM, listening to us on XM Radio from California. Go ahead, Stuart.
I would just like to say that I don't believe African-Americans believe that they're occupying our neighborhood. It's more so the whole thing goes further back. It's a lot of ingredients to the whole scenario, but the base is communication skills. Basically, nonverbal and any other form of communication. Approach each other as you approach your neighbor, like say, but yet officer-wise, yes, of course, stay sharp, you know what I'm saying, and protect yourself, but approach them just like you approach any other ethnic in any other neighborhood. And speak as sound as the same. You know what I'm saying? There was rumors that the officer cursed at the gentleman when he told him to get out the streets. I don't know if it's facts, but the thing is, just speak as you would speak to another ethnic and say, hey, you need to get out the streets or you won't get hurt or what have you. But yet, of course, stay sharp. So it's all about the interactions that build the friction to start the animosity. But yet, it's a deeper core, of course, from histories of racism and things, but presently, I think it's all about the communication skills and just speak to them like you speak to anyone else, view them as you view anyone else, and not to say it has to be just like, for instance, when they say,
well, I think I'm not going too far out on the limb by saying that probably in many police criminal justice courses over the last 15, 20 years, there are courses and there are lectures on the subject of how you treat minorities or people differently than you when you're encountering them. I can't believe that is not part of
what a police officer
goes through. But in the other side of the coin, which is what Anthony was talking about, is that doesn't seem to be the case if a young person is determined to be anti-authority and to challenge authority all the time, or smarting off, as Rand Paul said. You're going to be treated a little bit differently. And Rand Paul's point was, you know, that as a young teenager, he might have smarted off to somebody, but he didn't think that he would be getting shot if he did it. Back shortly from Chicago, I promise, more calls.
Are you serious?
That was the one who got the broom handle rammed up his record.
No.
He got shot 41 times.
One else would have...
Go ahead. Come on.
Go ahead. No, but there was one individual with police brutality in New York where they rammed him up his rectum with the police.
You're in Chicago, 24.
We're back. And by the way, we just during that break, we had a very heated conversation. I'm not looking to have a complete replay of that conversation because people started shouting over each other. But I think there were some important points that were made. And you were making a point because you've spent 22 years in the criminal justice system with prisoners. You're dealing with these people all the time.
On a consistent basis.
Explain to the audience, because I thought it was a very interesting explanation of the mindset. Now, you're a correctional officer, or were a correctional officer, but you were extrapolating that maybe that same attitude might exist with parole officers or patrol officers. Go ahead.
Absolutely. What I was getting at was drawing parallels between the work that I've done over the past 22 years when I'm working in the housing unit or if I'm working within an institutional setting. I, as a correctional officer, know instinctively that when you have certain individuals or certain groups lingering or they may be doing something out of the ordinary, I know instinctively that something is not right here. And so, therefore, I may need to pay a little bit more closer attention to these individuals. It's no different than these individuals, the police officers, that thin blue line being in these communities where these individuals on a consistent basis work in these communities. Now, they know just as well as we know that, hey, listen, on this date, I had to arrest this individual for whatever reason.
a week or so ago. On this date, I had to arrest an individual on this date a week ago or whatever. But the fact of the matter is I have gleaned this internal thing within me to say, hey, listen, maybe, just maybe, I need to watch out what's going on this project, not in this project, but on this corner over here, or this setting over here, just as an instinctive police officer would in anything we do. And so that's why I was saying police instincts at some point kick in, and at that point they say, hey, listen, let me just see what's going on.
And it was police instincts that led to Mapp versus Ohio in 1960.
Yeah, I understand.
So,
I understand.
And it was the police that lost that case. So let's be clear about that. But, Bruce, I think the thing that's missing here is the incident occurred about a week ago now, 8 days. That incident is done. The thing I'm more concerned about is, since the shooting, what has been the response, both at the local level, the county police, the state? The governor has been horrible.
Let him finish.
He's been horrible in the turn of a phrase. You know, in many protests, there's an expression, no justice, no peace. And he turns the phrase, well, no peace until we get justice. Ooh, really? So until we get peace, you're not going to ensure that there's justice here? Governor Nixon, you got to be better than that.
I want to talk about the response. And I'm going to talk about the response, but I want to go to Will in Skokie. He's been waiting a long time. He's going to ask a question, which is where I'm going next. Will, go ahead in Skokie.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi.
The point, I think, I'd like to see if all of you agree with this. I'd also like to tell you my experiences with living in a, quote, ghetto community, unquote. But would you say that, I would say that regardless of whether he was shot because he was perpetrating a crime or whether it was not a righteous shoot or whatever like this, there is absolutely no justification for the rioting that's occurring.
Tell us what happened, Philip, in your mind. Tell us what happens in the African-American community when something like this happens, a high-visibility thing happens, or word spreads. And again, the body sat on the street for 5 hours. I don't think there's any justification for that. That's based on what's been reported. If that's true, there's no justification for a man who has been shot by police to lay on a street for 5 hours. None. So my question is, in that five-hour period, the word gets out on the street, the word is spread, the buzz starts. Take us inside, if you will, the mind of the people in that community who chose to react in an antisocial criminal manner.
Okay, so I have to agree with Will. I don't condone rioting, as it were. That's not my sort of first choice. And I have the luxury of that being a rational choice for me. I'm not living in a community that has experienced this. And like I said before, this incident was the match that lit the fire. There was other stuff that has been going on in Ferguson for years that caused this situation. I don't know that, and this is, I guess, a differing mindset that I have. I don't know that the state always is going to have the power to stop something. Sometimes you better find another way to let people blow off some steam or do what they need to do to discharge the anger that they're holding.
Would everyone at this table acknowledge, and David, I want to get your response because we haven't heard from you for a while, that in every situation in mankind, when there's a problem, a serious problem, there are people that will take advantage of that problem, and they will see it as a way in which they can rob and loot and get away with whatever they're looking for. But it is, at least historically in recent years, it tends to happen in African American communities. Not exclusively, but it happens.
I condemn crimes perpetuated that you describe, but I think that African American community should be applauded for their restraint. You've got two unarmed black men killed every week by white cops.
The only reason why we're having a conversation is because you had a white cop shoot one black
teenager. How would whites act if black cops were killing white kids every week?
Just 2 weeks ago, we had 140 shootings in Chicago, and we had 45 murders. Was there this moral indignation or just righteous indignation?
If I witnessed a friend of mine or family member shot by a cop, unarmed, I might go
in an uncivil
tip over a car or get a little angry.
The only reason why they act like this is because the person that did the shooting was a white man. Come on, let's say it for what it is. That's what it is. If that wasn't the case, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Otherwise, we look at all the shootings that are happening in Chicago on a daily basis.
The person who committed the killing is paid by tax funds.
Absolutely.
He's got authority in that community. It's the relationship between the state and the citizen.
The law.
A gangster doesn't represent the state when he kills.
But to compare a police officer to a gangster is being a little bit disingenuous. Here you have an individual who is...
Ladies and gentlemen, we will be back with another full hour. I don't think we're going to get to a discussion of Iraq tonight because we have issues here in the country that we got to focus on first. But we will talk about the indictment of Rick Perry in hour number two. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Tonight featuring commentary by Anthony Anderson, Philip Beverly, Marty Garrity, and David Masiotra. And a little bit later on in the broadcast, we will hear from Kenny Raymeier from KLBJ Radio, and he will be talking about the indictment this week of Texas Governor Rick Perry. Our phone lines open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, you can email us at brucedumont@museum.tv. And if you'd like to tweet a question to us, it's at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. A tweet did come in for you, Philip, and they wanted you to comment on the role of voting in Missouri and what can be done to improve the lot of those who reside in that community.
Yes, there's got to be some responsibility taken by the residents of Ferguson. It is unconscionable that at their last election they would have had 12% voter turnout. 12%. So 1 in 8 of their residents thought it important enough to vote in a town that has a 67.3% African-American population. That means there was a lot of black folks in Ferguson that didn't vote.
But
shame on you for doing that.
But how would that have made a difference? Because that town, its state representative is black. Its U.S. congressman is black. The governor is a Democrat. The president of the United States is black and a Democrat. I mean, where in the structure
We go in the other direction, Bruce. What's their town council or their city council look like? What does their school board look like? Their school board is all white. They have one African-American
on the city council, though.
In a town that's two-thirds African-American, you might think that it'd have two-thirds.
What is the here's a tough question. By the way, for those let me finish. For those around that heard me say that we're going to talk about the indictment of Rick Perry, we will in about 30 minutes, just to let you know that we're going to do that. But the question I would want, because we dealt in the first hour with a lack of respect or fear of the police, a lack of respect for the police in many sectors of the African-American community. What, in your view, and let's spend a segment, if we can get some heat and light on this as well, or light more than heat, what can be done, in your view, Anthony, so that there's a greater respect for police in the African-American community?
Well, I think that the police officers of that community should get to know the residents. I mean, that's first and foremost. I mean, there should be more of a relationship with law enforcement in those communities.
Do the residents want that, though?
Whether or not the residents want that, I don't think so. I mean, if you ask me if it's okay to police give out the surveys to the residents on how you think we should best serve you, I mean, that's taking a little to an extreme. But the fact of the matter is there needs to be a conversation, a dialogue in that community between the police and the residents of that community.
Philip, what's your answer to that question?
I think community policing is a start, but I think there needs to be the deeper conversation. Are there other sorts of problems present in that community that need to be addressed as well. Because I don't want to see, because it's an extreme case, because a life was lost here, that it's a policing problem. I don't know that it's a policing problem as much as it is a human relations problem within that community.
David. But,
yeah, and you could probably have that conversation in countless communities across the country. I think there's an important role here for President Obama to play, not necessarily as executive policymaker, but in terms of the one who has a bully pulpit, first African-American president. Perhaps he can articulate a vision for moving forward, trying to repair the fractured relationship between police and black Americans, trying to speak to the country in a moral terminology that can galvanize, mobilize, and energize some new ways of thinking and some new ways of acting and creating around this problem. Because it isn't just police procedure, political theater. It's really spiritual warfare. The soul of the nation is at stake as long as we have a separate and unequal legal system. So we really need culturally a Brown versus Board style reformation or a movement that pushes us in that direction.
Marty, on the issue of respect, how do you build respect? Two ways. How do you build respect in the black community towards authority figures, police, and how do you deal with those who have the authority to have a respect for the feelings and mistrust that people of color may have towards them because they're wearing a blue uniform?
Well, at the risk of being of oversimplifying or over-technologizing it, one of the big problems may well be air conditioning in cars, because when you had a policeman walking the beat, literally walking the beat, there was way greater connection between people on the street and that cop on the beat. Nowadays, a cop is in his car and he keeps the windows rolled up, and he does. He's just not as in touch.
But he's fearful. But he's fearful of getting out of the car, is he not?
If
a black police officer or a white, let's say a police officer, doesn't make whether it's a black police officer or not, they got a blue uniform on, at least in Chicago they got a blue uniform on. They're walking down an inner city street in Chicago or any city in the United States. At this moment in time, do you believe that police officer would be respected, and would they have fear for their lives?
Absolutely not. They would not be respected, Bruce, because one of the things you have to look at in certain communities, especially on the south and west sides of Chicago, is this. Most of those individuals don't respect themselves, and I say that because all they do is look at their communities, look at the way they treat their communities, look at how they keep up their communities. If you can't respect your own community, how can you respect someone who comes in outside of your community? And so that's one of the biggest problems that I see. We have to learn, or they have to learn, to respect themselves and respect life as we know it.
Philip?
The they that Anthony's talking about, I have to be able to quantify in my mind, because that sort of sweeping generalization I find a little disturbing. I know that there are people who live in certain circumstances who are working poor, who work really hard, two and a half jobs.
And to those individuals, I'm not saying that they don't have respect.
I would say that that's a minority within those communities.
Well, that minority just happens to have the majority in that community held hostage. Because you know, and I know, when was the last time you saw a major multinational corporation decided, you know what, I'm going to open up shop on Madison and Kedzie, or I'm going to open up shop on 79th and Jeffries? When was the last time you had a corporation say, we're going to move over here because we know that we can do business in these areas and our employees can come here and leave and go back home and have, and come back the next day?
David, do you think that's the reason why, again, we're getting into sort of a cultural daily operation, but it's sort of what we're talking about here. Do you believe that's part of the problem here?
No, Anthony makes a good point. No entrepreneur is going to open a business on a street where he feels he's at constant risk of robbery, vandalism, or murder. But we also have to keep in mind what Martin Luther King said in the 60s, that if we don't fully integrate and assimilate black people into the institutions of the country, economically and educationally, you're going to lose the inner cities to drug dependency and violence. And that's exactly what's happened.
Absolutely. Well, how do we go from having I have a dream in the 60s to I have a scheme with Obama in 2014 is beyond me.
A political shot has been fired across the bow, and we will get reaction from our Democrats. 1-800-723-8290. When we come back, we're going to hear from a homicide detective. He wants to weigh in on this conversation, as well as a former police officer. Bruce Dumont back. Thanks very much for joining us. Here is a email that's come in from the Masseys. Could the panel discuss why the African-American community doesn't react with the same passion when on a weekly basis truly innocent children are slaughtered by gangbangers?
They do react with the same passion. A number of community-based organizations have candlelight vigils. They have marches in communities. If you're saying maybe we should riot.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's what she's saying exactly. Why don't they riot when there's a black-on-black crime as opposed to having a white man kill a black person?
Listen,
I think the history of this country would
not the slavery thing
against
again.
This.
Come on, I mean,
you
come
really,
on, man.
Well, you really think that that
I'm not discounting slavery?
Vigil?
Of course you are. You just did. Well, first, thank
not
you.
Not at all. Not at all. I'm not discounting it. But the fact of the matter is, we have a black president, a black attorney general. We had a black secretary of state. I mean, for you to say all of a sudden blacks are being mistreated,
and those are outliers.
But those may be outliers. But the fact of the matter,
maybe outliers.
Now, you
those
now
are outliers.
Have individuals that are black that are in positions of authority throughout this country.
Is there a way? Okay. Is there a way? Let's just take a second. Is there a way? You've articulated the fact that there are many African Americans in significant
prominent positions
in media as well as politics. You were talking about politics. Is there any way that individual or collective voices could be channeled into delivering and communicating to a constituency that may only be able to be reached by them? Anybody want to tackle that?
Yeah.
I'm going to let you take.
Well, if I could respond to the email very quickly.
Sure.
As Philip points out, there is a tremendous reaction to so-called black-on-black crime. They're stop the violence rallies all the time. I don't know what else they're supposed to do. But this is a hypocrisy we're seeing with the right wing. Constantly crowing about loss of liberty and big government abuse of power, but in the face of lethal abuse of power, in the face of human rights violations that actually threaten millions of people, there is either eerie silence or a pathetic deference to authority, which is odd for a group of people who, on the political level, claim to have such skepticism of concentrated government power.
All right, let's go to Bill, listening to us in Chicago on WLS Radio. Go ahead.
Yeah, I got a couple of things I'd like to touch on. I'm a homicide detective, been one for over 20 years, and been on the job over 30 years. Roughly, when you say that the body was on the ground for 5 hours, just so you know, it's not uncommon in Chicago. It happens all the time. And if you think it's disrespectful, I can tell you that there's been policemen who've been shot and killed who lay down the street for hours while the crime scene had to be processed. We didn't enjoy it. We didn't want to do that, but we didn't want to move the body until all the evidence and all the information could be collected.
Bill, just stop for a second. In Chicago, by the way, you've explained something to me. Is there a procedure, according to the books in Chicago, that a body that is on the street is supposed to be investigated within a defined period of time?
No, it's supposed to – their call for the department is as quickly as it can be done correctly, right. Which means that if you can't get the crime lab out, if they're tied up on two other shootings or three other homicides and you're waiting for the crime lab to come, that body has to sit there until it's processed. Now you've got a small town that probably hardly has homicides, and they got now probably calling outside jurisdictions to come in to do process evidence and everything else. That was not a disrespectful move. And I think if they would have moved that body 5 minutes after he was shot and rushed it out of there, then the cry would have been, uh-oh, they covered everything up and they rushed the body out. So there's really no win on that.
Does everybody agree, by the way, let me ask you, I'll start with you and then I'm going to get everybody around the table. Do you agree that there was the official autopsy? The family has now called for an independent autopsy. They've hired someone that they will have do the investigation. And the Attorney General of the United States said that the United States Justice Department will have a third autopsy. Do you think in this particular case, Bill, your response first, do you think it's a good idea to have more than one autopsy?
Sure. I think I don't think there's a problem with multiple jurisdictions doing autopsies as long as they all come out with the same information. If they start contradicting each other, then it's going to look like some kind of cover-up. And the problem, even though it's medical science, I've had, you know, one coroner tell me one thing and another medical examiner tell me another thing, and it's based on their experience and their visual observations and so forth. It's not always a perfect science. So if this ends up being where these autopsies turn out to be somehow differently by interpretation, you're going to have more problems than you had before.
Reaction from everybody around the table. Philip?
So I appreciate Bill's point about processing the scene, and that's going to take as long as it takes. The problem that I have is in a community that there's tensions already, communicate it. That's all you have to do. Let people know what's going on in the process so you can mitigate their response of, oh, well, this is being disrespectful and see how he's being treated, if you tell them why. And maybe you get a different reaction that
Phil,
way.
Do you honestly think that if the police were forthright and saying, hey, listen, we're here to preserve and protect not only your rights but the rights of this individual who is laying before us, do you honestly think that they would that would quell the rioters from doing what they do or what?
I'm not Kreskin, so I don't know what would happen.
But
I don't
there are
predict
people
that.
If you would explain to the rioters,
hey, listen, guys, we have to investigate the scene.
Well,
could you please
stop,
at least
let's
put your badge down
a little
bit? Would you lose your gun for right now? And you over here, just relax. We're just trying to find out what the facts are. And at that point, we'll go back to doing whatever we was doing beforehand.
So
are you trying to say that?
Let's look at what is factual. And what they didn't do is factual. What you're talking about is sort of fantastic, if you will. It's fantasy. We don't know what would happen. We know what happened when they didn't communicate, don't we? Because they didn't communicate. So we know what happened in that instance.
But we assume that they would act civilized in both instances, and that is just not the case.
We've got to take another call. John, Austin, Texas, also identifying yourself as an ex-police officer. Go ahead, John. John, are you there? John? John is not there. John is not there, but I do have a response here from a patrolman. This is through the email. I sit in my patrol car in utter disbelief at this discussion. To the nutcase that referenced Skip Gates, if I'm dispatched to a 911 call of a possible burglary in process and I show up, see a person on scene matching the description of the dispatch, and that person refuses to identify himself and basically tells me to screw myself, then of course it escalates. Totally the fault of the Harvard elitist who was above the lowly police officer and couldn't be bothered, oh wait, I forgot, helpless victim of racism. As to Ferguson, what's an appropriate resolution, folks? We all know what needs to... No, we know all need to know right. Unarmed teenager executed right. Why not get a rope and string Wilson up somewhere without delay? I love the continuing use of the word unarmed in every single media reference to this incident, as if an unarmed man cannot possibly resent a lethal threat. Every time one chooses to fight a policeman, that fight involves a firearm. Get beaten unconscious by an unarmed criminal, and you know at his mercy, good luck. You guys want to reference the captured witness video today, where someone not posturing for the media reported Brown charging at the officer with the police officer's weapon pointed at him. Or does that not matter, just like the thug behavior on the store video didn't matter? Which one of you guys is unafraid of an angry 6'4", 290-pound man that charges you even though you've got him at gunpoint? I'm sick or disgusted at the race-baiting, anti-police ideology occupying force. You should be ashamed. Let the investigation play out, or might that be too inconvenient to your narrative? That's a Chicago police officer responding.
Well, I can wholeheartedly agree with what he's saying in that piece there, Bruce, and that's coming from a correctional setting here, that in most cases people don't know what the average individual will do. But based on behavior that this person has exhibited in the past, you can pretty much gauge what that individual is going to do in the future. I'm not saying that this Mr. Brown was about to kill anyone, but the fact of the matter is he was aggressive in nature way before this incident started.
The dearest policeman in my life tells me that he has encountered, and this is a big guy, he's a big, big guy, he has encountered little guys who have, because of what they're on, because of what drug they're on or whatever it is, have immense strength, have the ability to overpower him. This is if the video that has been described is accurate, this is a guy who was at great risk of his life when this guy was running toward him. And remember, we do know, there are a few facts that we do know. Everybody, we do know that there were bullets fired in the police car, okay? And we also know that there were a number of bullets fired after the bullets were fired in the police car. This story that the policeman that just emailed tells is consistent with those facts. In other words, that Brown ran away. The copper, the Wilson, said stop, freeze, whatever, and Brown came back toward him, and he told him to stop, and then he fired several shots. All those, that allegation is consistent with the things that we absolutely do know as to what people heard and what people reported.
Well, the piece of that which is the most intriguing to me is that shots were fired in the police car. Now, if shots are fired in the proximity of a police car, it's pretty hard to believe that somebody wasn't hit.
Well,
would everybody agree with that? If shots are going around in a police car or in a small car, someone probably got to be hit.
Both witnesses that are talking about what happened say that shots were fired in the police car and nobody was hit at that time.
Okay. We've got to pause. We are out of time for this discussion, but when we come back, we're going to talk about a crime of a different nature, at least according to one prosecutor in Texas, and they're going after the governor. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for being with us tonight. Nice to have you with us, and we're going to switch gears now. Thank you all for those that have called in on this very combustible subject. We're getting lots of tweets and also email response to the broadcast. And again, the unfortunate thing about this case this week is there will be another case like this at some point in the future. It's like the random shootings we deal with in this country. I mean, they're not going to go away forever, and unfortunately there will be another one. And we hope to, in the next couple of weeks, maybe come back to this discussion. Maybe have a little more, light to offer the heat that we provided tonight. Another huge political story, a national political story that broke just a couple of days ago, occurred in Texas, where Rick Perry, the longest serving governor in Texas history, has been indicted. And of course, he was on the comeback trail to perhaps running once again for the Republican presidential nomination. Kenny Rahmeyer joins us right now for many, many years. Kenny has followed us every Sunday night on KLBJ. And Kenny, it's nice to have you back on Beyond the Beltway with, again, big breaking stories out of Austin, Texas.
Yeah, thanks, Bruce. Good to talk to you again.
What was the essence of the indictment against the governor, and what was his immediate response?
Governor Perry, late Friday afternoon, was indicted on two counts, abuse of official capacity and coercion of a public servant. So what's behind that is the governor was accused of abusing his power when he publicly threatened to veto upwards of $7+ million in funding for a unit here, a state agency, if you will, that investigates public corruption amongst politicians. And the wrinkle in this is the person that heads up the public integrity unit out of the Travis County DA's office is the Travis County DA, who last spring was arrested in a case of drunken driving, and it's That piece of this story is now national as well, because you've probably seen the video. It's not very flattering, her behavior to those who were booking her and trying to arrest her and so forth. So that's kind of the net of it, Bruce, and it really comes down to, is this criminal activity or just a hardball politics in the state of Texas?
Now, how compare with what happened with Rick Perry to other prosecutions? He has referred to it as a political prosecution. Are there other charges of political prosecutions in Texas? I think most people listening to the program know that Tom DeLay, former Republican leader in the House, was also indicted. Was this the same office, and is this the same prosecutor?
You know, based on what the legal and the political experts here are saying, you know, the closest precedent to this goes back to 1917, when then the governor of Texas was trying to withhold some funding from the University of Texas because they wouldn't fire some faculty and staff that he wasn't very happy with. I also want to touch on, Bruce, you asked me the first question, what's been his response? Of course, he's been very defiant. He had a press conference yesterday afternoon and was on Fox News this morning pretty much saying the same thing. He's going to fight it all the way, and he's not going to listen to any of this stuff about he doesn't have the authority to do it, because he believes the Texas Constitution gives him that line item veto authority. And from a First Amendment standpoint, by calling for this disgraced DA to resign, he felt like he was very much within his rights. The crux of it is, when you combine those two, there was almost an element of quid pro quo, and that's maybe where they might trip him up.
Now, in this particular case, we have the court of public opinion, and we have the court of legal opinion. It will take time for the court of legal opinion to play out, as it generally does in this country.
But right. It could be a year before this thing goes to trial, according to one local NBC TV station here.
But in the court of public opinion, for the last, I would say, 6 weeks, including discussions on this program, there was a general thought that Rick Perry, who at one point looked like it was foolish for him to try for the Republican nomination again because of his abysmal showing last time, There have been positive stories written about him, and there appeared to be, at least in the national news media, some people, you know, bringing up the fact or their opinion that Rick Perry could emerge as a viable candidate for the Republican nomination. So my question to you would be, this would be the second sitting Republican governor, with Chris Christie being the second one, who would be running for the Republican nomination under some form of cloud. Although Christie has not been indicted, he is under investigation by federal and state officials. So does this, from a political standpoint, I mean, the real guts of it, it may be dirty, but does this eliminate his political aspirations?
Well, I don't think so, and here's why. First, you're right. The timing is not good. It's going to be a distraction for him. He's going to have to explain the story when he's out on the campaign trail. I believe he's going to spin that in such a way that he will suggest, relative to these indictments, he has the authority of veto power, and as he spins the story about this disgraced DA, he will suggest to the crowd that they would do the same thing he did. You don't want that kind of person heading up an entity within state government that's supposed to be investigating public corruption amongst politicians. But bottom line, Bruce, I think he's going to, if you remember this, very successful, and this gets back to your other point about he's kind of methodically been the comeback kid, right? In fact, the Washington Post not too long ago said he might be the next comeback kid. But he had that almost a week's worth of publicity with President Obama over the border situation and all the illegal kids coming across. Right. And he got a lot of accolades for having a very successful standoff with the president on that immigration issue. And I believe he's going to try to spin this in his favor, Bruce, and say he's the candidate. When President Obama won't secure the border, I will. He's going to say the residents of Travis County and Austin, if they're okay with having a disgraced DA in charge of a $7.5 million entity then that's their problem. But I'm not going to stand for it because I've got higher principles and so forth. So I believe he's going to try to spend both of these in depositors for him as he's out on the campaign trail.
Okay.
In fact, the news says he's going to be in New Hampshire at the end of this week. Of course, he's now got an arraignment to deal with, and that's just another problem he's going to have to put up with.
Kenny, that's your perspective. Thanks very much. Stay on the line. I now want to get reaction just on the political aspect of it right now from our guests who are here. And I want to start with our Republican, Marty Garrity. Again, from a political standpoint, we're now, is Governor Perry damaged goods, and is he significantly tarnished that he's not likely to be a viable candidate? In other words, he can't spin his way to the nomination. What do you think?
I think that the answer to both of your questions is no, he's not that badly damaged. But it is true that he now has talking points that he's got to divert himself from because he's got to answer these stupid questions, and that'll slow him down.
I don't think he's damaged goods. But also I see that the Democrats see that there may be a front runner in Rick Perry, so they're doing their homework real early so they can be often said that, hey, listen, you do have an indicted governor running for president of the United States.
All right, let's ask our Democrat now, Philip Beverly.
I don't know that it was the Democrats, considering all the criticism that our party receives from the other side about being inept and unable to do things. I wouldn't necessarily say it was Democrats who were behind this, but maybe it was Republicans who were behind it for exactly the same reason.
Because
the governor, he would have to go through a primary process.
No, but you're saying that the Republicans would get the Democratic local prosecutor to indict the governor?
Politics does make strange bedfellows,
Kenny,
doesn't it?
Do you want to respond to that one? That was kind of off the wall. What was your response to that one?
Well, I will throw this into it, that a Republican judge appointed the special prosecutor who has brought these charges against the governor. The special prosecutor, a criminal defense attorney in San Antonio, began his career as a federal prosecutor under George H.W. Bush. And the Fort Worth Star-Telegram reports there were two Republicans on the Travis County grand jury. But having said all that, the other interesting political piece of this, local politics, is if this DA were to have resigned, which certainly a lot of people here locally wanted her to do that based on phone calls we received on our station, News Radio KLBJ. She didn't. One of the big reasons is because the governor gets to appoint her successor if she were to resign, and nobody in Democratic politics here locally wanted that, so she stuck it out. She said, I'm not going to run again. I'm going to retire at the end of my term.
Now, let's also put in context here, because when you talk about Texas politics, there's Rick Perry, again, the longest-serving governor in the state. You have Ted Cruz, the senator, who's also talking about running for political office.
Right.
You're also talking about the Bush family. And historically, even though Perry was Bush's lieutenant governor, there's not been a close relationship between the Bush family and Perry. Is that correct?
You're right. And to your point about Senator Ted Cruz, Wayne Slater, who knows politics better than anybody here in the state of Texas, writes for the Dallas Morning News. He said in one of his pieces today he believes Senator Cruz could benefit among the evangelical Tea Party conservative base that may have had a hard time deciding Rick Perry or Ted Cruz. This could give Cruz the edge.
So the conspiratorial theory that this may be a Republican hatchet job is not totally off base.
No, I guess I'm having a hard time warming up to that piece of it.
Okay.
I've tried elements to it just to give you context for the story, but okay. I think the governor is on solid ground if he'll stick to the adage of, would you want this disgraced DA responsible for $7.5 million?
Kenny, stay on the line. We got to pause for a break. And again, if we had, well, we'll talk about it after the break. Back shortly from Chicago and Austin, Texas. Bruce Dumont back from Beyond the Beltway, and Kenny Rahmeyer from KLBJ, who joins us on the broadcast this evening. And he follows us every Sunday night on KLBJ, one of our longest affiliates now. Kenny, I want to continue with the discussion about the political fallout. You sort of disregarded at least a suggestion by one of our by our Democrat here that this somehow conceivably could have been a Republican inside job. We wanted to just clarify something. The indictment was filed by someone who will continue to be in office for another 2 years. This woman is going to, she's sticking around, right?
The Travis County DA heads up the Public Integrity Unit. That's the unit that the governor vetoed the funding for. Yes, she continues in office. A special prosecutor.
And that's
was
Rosemary Lemberg.
Though.
That's Rosemary Lemberg is her name.
Yes, sir.
For how much longer, Bruce?
How long is she going to be in office?
I think another couple of years, till 2016,
So she's around for a couple of years. Okay. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that, but this special prosecutor is the one that convened the grand jury, and I was wanting to provide some context that that guy, a Republican judge, appointed him, and he started his career as a federal prosecutor under George H.W. Bush administration. At least that's according to his online bio.
Now, the state Democratic Party and Congressman Castro have called for the governor to step down and resign.
Right.
Has there been any more bipartisan call for him to step down, either from newspapers or even any Republicans?
I've heard nothing locally. In fact, of course, he's touting the likes of David Axelrod,
yes,
the former advisor for President Obama, Alan Dershowitz, a renowned liberal attorney, I would say, who have said in as much that these allegations and the lawsuit and such is going to be, it's a stretch.
Yeah, I mean, David Axelrod said that based on this was a tweet he sent out, it's very sketchy. He said the indictment is very sketchy. Now, the governor is leaving office, is scheduled to leave office in January. Now, there's a Republican, there's a battle going on as to who is going to replace him.
Right.
And Wendy Davis is the Democrat. She's the one, the anti or pro-choice person that is sort of a poster child for that issue. But the Attorney General, Greg Abbott, most people would say that he is likely to continue the tradition of Republican governors, but he is the Attorney General.
He's done well in the polling. He's done very well in the polling, and the news reports today were such that she stopped short of calling for Governor Perry to resign, but she said something like these are very serious allegations.
Well, again, will this drag Greg Abbott, because he's the Attorney General, will he somehow be dragged into this discussion, and could it hurt his political chances?
I don't see that in a red state where he's done well consistently in the polls up to this point, and I don't think this plays into his chances at all.
If he were to resign, who is the lieutenant governor? Who would become the next Texas governor?
Well, that would be David Dewhurst, who, of course, lost a couple of high-profile races. He has not done well in his most recent tries to become the next senator from Texas to take Kay Bailey Hutchison's job, is one example.
Is this an example? I mean, the people around the nation, one of the pundits on the Sunday shows today said, well, this is just rough and tough Texas politics, that, the Democrat in this particular case, they have an axe to grind with the Republican governor. They're going to embarrass him, right, as he's, launching a second presidential bid. How is it being viewed by average people on the street? You're going to hear from them literally in about 8 minutes when you go on the air with your show tonight. But
yeah, right.
What's the reaction you're hearing there?
You know, given, Bruce, that this story broke literally late Friday afternoon, there really hasn't, and it's a weekend, of course, so there hasn't been much time for any public outrage per se. I will tell you this, locally, there were a lot of people that were not in favor of the disgraced DA staying in office. And yet, she was elected to that position, and unless she resigned, and there were some legal wranglings to try to knock her out, and those failed. So I don't see this really hurting the governor locally here at all.
What happened in the case of her, I mean, the DUI, was she convicted of DUI?
Yes, she was, and she served about half of a 45-day sentence in jail, and she, on her own, sought some treatment for some things she said she had to deal with.
Okay, so she's maybe getting better, but we don't know whether she's drinking and driving anymore.
You're right, Bruce. We don't know that.
We don't know that. But she's focusing her attention on going after Governor Perry at the moment.
Well, she's still DA responsible for Travis County. This is a blue dot in a red state, and I guess how that could play out, you know, long term. His attorneys may file for a change of venue here, saying, look, this guy, I mean, it is a blue dot in a red state. We need to get a different pool of jurors who may not be familiar with Rosemary Lindbergh and all the rest.
But again, you suggested as this moves through the process of the courts, I mean, it could be very, very slow. In other words, Rick Perry could be swinging in the wind during a Republican primary, and again, he would have to be on the defensive. But again, in the middle of all this, there's the possibility there would be a trial, and he would be vindicated, which would give him a real boost.
And those are some of the unknowns, Bruce. Is he going to try to cut a deal and get this off the plate, or will he just slog it out, and it could go on for months and months?
Kenny Rahmeyer has been our guest. If you're listening to us on KLBJ, he's going to be right back right here at KLBJ in about 10 minutes when we go off the air and we put in network news. And we thank you very much for being with us tonight, Kenny. And also our thanks around the table to Anthony Anderson and Marty Garrity and David Mosiotra and Philip Beverly for their guesting on our program tonight, offering some really hot discussion of a very, very hot issue. We'll talk about Iraq next week. I can promise you folks it will not be solved. By next week, we'll continue our discussion about U.S. foreign policy there next week. Until this time, this is Bruce Dumont. Thanks to Jenny B. Productions for producing the program in association with WLS Talk Radio, and to Todd Nebel and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.